Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, September the 28th. And it's time for the Week in Review, when we invite two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the big news stories of each week. And we invite you to call in with the observation from the news this week that you would like to talk about at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us today Georgia Durst-Lottie, professor of political science at Beloit College and author, most recently, of Creating Gender, the Sexual Politics of Welfare Policy. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And also with us, Margaret Farrow, former lieutenant governor of Wisconsin, who is currently active in public policy-related organizations. She is chair of Waukesha County Action Network and chair of the Board of Wisconsin Eye. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks to both of you for being with us. And I hope we have a lively give and take. Both of you are on the phone, so you can't really see each other, but feel free to just jump in when you feel the need, or don't wait for me. You don't have to wait for me to say it's your turn.
Okay. Good morning.
All right. Let's start with the beginning of the week. On Monday, quite a stir when the president of Iran was invited to speak at Columbia University. Here's the president of Columbia University introducing Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
The people of Wisconsin need to know who's at...
That was not him. That was somebody else. Let's get to the right cut here. Here we go.
Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator. In a December 2005 state television broadcast, you described the Holocaust as a fabricated legend. 1 year later, you held a two-day conference of Holocaust deniers. For the illiterate and ignorant, this is dangerous propaganda. When you come to a place like this, this makes you quite simply ridiculous. You are either brazenly provocative or astonishingly uneducated. Your absurd comments about the debate over the Holocaust both defy historical truth and make all of us who continue to fear humanity's capacity for evil shudder at this closure of memory, which is always virtue's first line of defense. Will you cease this outrage?
And then the president of Iran had to comment that it was rude of Ray Bollinger to be introducing him in such a way. What did you make of that, Georgia Durst-Lottie?
Well, it was rude to introduce him in that way. But having set that one aside right away, I can say I was absolutely shocked that there was such candor anywhere in kind of political discourse. It was amazing, and it was refreshing, and it was academic freedom at its best. And the president of Iran is a PhD, so he knows how this works. This should not have been a real surprise for him, and I was glad to see it.
No, I'm sorry, I said Ray. I meant Lee Bollinger. Margaret Farrell?
Well, I think I have somewhat the same sense of awe over what happened as I listened to it. I thought that he was extremely direct. It was the type of thing you would say perhaps in another setting very easily, but I thought it was exhibiting our freedom of speech to the ultimate, because we saw the explanation that he was coming here and that he was invited to be other than just at the UN because we are a country that has freedom of speech. And I thought the president exhibited that in his introduction quite directly to him. So I was, yes, surprised also. I was very pleased to hear it. I thought that, for one thing, he had his attention in a way that perhaps he would not have had if it had been just a reference to him made at a different time, that he wouldn't have paid as much attention to it. So I thought that the president of Iran certainly had to be aware of what was being said and react to it.
And there was no way that was a softball question from a student.
No, no, true.
Yeah, what about some Iranians, though, are saying that they're critics of Ahmadinejad in Iran, and they're saying that that this bully treatment and the demonizing of the Iranian president has only strengthened Ahmadinejad's hand back at home.
Well, I don't know that anyone here in the country has a responsibility for that. We have to react to him as the American side of the issues. I think his request, for example, to go to the site of the 9/11 attack had to be reacted not in terms of what the Iranians would think of our reaction to the request, but what Americans would think. So that's up to them. I think he did what he had to do here at the university.
You know, in almost everything that happens in politics, it's not either or, but both and, to some degree at least. And I suspect that the Iranian dissidents are accurate in saying that it strengthened his hand with a certain segment of the Iranian population. And yet, I think that, like Margaret, I think that it needed to be done.
Mm-hmm. Then the next day, Ahmadinejad spoke before the UN and, in essence, said that he's that the nuclear issue is closed. A Bush administration official said that Ahmadinejad is the only person who thinks that. Georgia Durislati, is that right?
I tell you, I am really happy to see France and Germany stepping up on this one. They've had a long set of relationships with Iran that we haven't. You know, just much longer, especially France, and especially France with nuclear. So when France is taking the lead in this, it's really significant, and it's good to have a whole team working on this rather than to see the United States go it alone, as it too often does.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would agree. I think historically, since the kind of the immersion on the international scene of the atomic power and the nuclear threat in 1945, historically, the fear has always been it would get into the hands or become controlled by a government that was not responsible, that was somewhat in a totally different place than civilized society, let's say. And I think we see evidence that everyone has a fear of that. I just saw a recent poll that 80% of the people in this country believe that Iran is going after this not for the nuclear energy aspect, but in fact to develop their nuclear strength for military purposes. And I think I agree we cannot just be one voice alone in trying to control this march toward what could be just terribly, terribly well, it would just be an awful outcome if they ever begin to flex that strength of theirs, if they continue to develop it. So I think our president and the leaders of other countries have to be responsible in trying to control this.
Excuse me. I don't think that that it's a terrible surprise that they want to be more powerful and perceived as more powerful, and certainly this will give it to them, and you know, that's part of what's going on here too.
Yeah, I'll let you take a drink of water, Georgia Durislati. There was a debate this week, a Democratic candidate debate that was on MSNBC, and I know that one of the highlights of that debate was John Edwards was criticizing Hillary Clinton for on a number of issues, but one of them was saying that she should not have voted for the resolution that declares Iran's Revolutionary Army a terrorist organization, because John Edwards says this is just gives President Bush another blank check to have some sort of military action with Iran. Is that how you read that, Margaret Farrell?
Well, I think it's interesting when you have a candidate who now has stepped outside of the political arena of accountability to constituents, which is what John Edwards, for the time being at least, is in that position, and then being able to sit on the sidelines and comment on votes that have to be taken as a responsible member of a legislative body. So I found that interesting. But on the other hand, I think that it's unfortunate that in this case the partisan debate over this, and this is kind of intrapartisan, saying what you should or shouldn't do, making the hand of Bush stronger or not, I think that's unfortunate if it begins to get in the way of our foreign policy that is for the, you know, the safety of our country and its future compared to a country like Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's true that that there is some intra-partisan dynamics going on here. It's pretty clear, and it's always bad when that happens to foreign policy, whether it's between the parties or within the party. So, you know, it's something to take a look at. If we see what's happening on Iran's border up in the Kurdish area with Iraq, Iran's been attacking up there for over a month and bombing and going after Kurdish rebels. And so we see this kind of aggression again. The tension between Iran and Iraq is longstanding. I mean, we're talking centuries, if not a millennium, you know. What happens in Iran is critical to what happens in the region. And we can't have them becoming a rogue power over there, and it is truly a concern to anybody who understands what's going on.
Do you, Georgia Gerislotti, think that this is, Edwards called this vote a potential first step toward war against Iran? Is that what's going on here?
Well, I hope Bush is out of power before we get to a place where we need that.
Well, a lot, and again, I've talked to various guests who say that a military strike against Iran is going to happen at the urging of Dick Cheney, by the way.
Well, I mean, Dick Cheney has urged a lot of things that have proven perhaps to be way overstepping what should have happened in the first place. So it is not a surprise to me that people see that as a possibility, and I think there is some possibility that it would happen. I certainly hope it doesn't happen. I think there are many steps between here and some kind of military attack that would be much better, and we really don't need to escalate that region of the world anymore.
Margaret Farrell?
Well, I think, first of all, it's already been commented that the complexity of that area, both historically and what is going on now in the modern day, is something very difficult for the rest of the area, our continent and our area over here. People don't even perhaps know exactly where the countries are. For that reason, it's hard for people to understand it just as a general thing. As far as what we are doing, I often think the security involved and the 24/7 news cycle reacting to what they think they know as the whole story is often a very different thing. And I would I have faith in our military leaders. I have faith in the effort that we are trying to put forward. First of all, the reason we went into Iraq to begin with, to try to bring some sanity and some humane existence for the peoples, no matter what part of the country and what part of the religious backgrounds they were. That was the motivation of it, because of the danger to the overall security of the world that Saddam Hussein was threatening at the time, clearly with every evidence, though nothing that could be substantiated later, of where his intentions were going. So to vilify one individual and say there's the nugget that's causing all the problem, I disagree with that. I think there is far more going into these decisions than perhaps the news is seeing on or wanting to bring forward on balance.
Well, and you know, I absolutely disagree with why we went into Iraq, but you know, that's old at this point. You know, I mean, I think this comes back to Margaret's earlier point about the belief among Americans that Iran's building this nuke potential for weaponry. I mean, because that's what they hear. And they don't really know what's going on in the region. Now, I happen to think that they want to position themselves to be a in the nuclear club, and have that kind of power and respect that comes from that. So whether they actually produce the weapons or not, they want to be seen as having that potential. And this is all fueled by the 24/7 news cycle. I agree wholeheartedly with that, because they can use this for propagandistic purposes that become very important on the diplomatic scene.
We have many other issues to talk about during this Friday Week in Review, and we will do that after this short pause. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Georgia Durst-Lottie, a professor of political science at Beloit College, and Margaret Farrow, former lieutenant governor of the state of Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, Jean Purcell in for Ben Marins for At Issue between 4 and 6 this afternoon. And after 4, as is the case every Friday, it's Your Views on the News, a program similar to what we're doing right now, The Week in Review with Georgia Durst-Lottie and Margaret Farrow. And Linda in Monroe is our first caller who will change the subject for us. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, guests. Last night at the Republican debate in Baltimore, which was carried exclusively by public television, which I give them credit for, none of the top candidates showed up. Now, this looks as though that they really don't care about minorities, and the Republican candidates that did show up really criticized their party for this. They even talked about this at the 8 o'clock program or the news on the news at 8 o'clock. And please comment.
Yeah, the front runners, the GOP front runners, did not show up for this debate on minority issues on PBS. Margaret Farrell, was that a mistake?
First of all, I think that they are running a marathon of debates right now, and I'm almost exhausted watching the schedule that began several months ago with the type of programming that's being done. And you know, most candidates would like exposure, and they, as campaign managers or managers of their campaigns, because it all rests in the candidates' decision-making, even though they have a whole cadre of others helping them plan things, I think they find themselves really stretched. And I don't know when this one was planned. I don't know. There are others that they are going to miss. There's others they have missed. To have had the you know, read into it the fact that the top front runners could not care about these issues, I don't think that's accurate. I would not want to think that's accurate, certainly, and I don't think the majority of them would want to have people think that is accurate. But I just am amazed at their ability to be in attendance and to participate in this, as I say, a marathon of debates that are going on right now. And you figure we're still, 14 months out from the election.
Well, it is indeed a marathon. There's no question about that. You're right. And it rather speaks to the stamina any president needs. This is one thing they say that's good about a long campaign, that you get to see how much physical vitality the candidates have. Listen, you know, it's a strategic choice here, at least a tactical choice. Where do you go when you have all these debates going on and the need to raise money and going to places where you're going to be working with your base rather than receive really tough questions? Because Republican policies have, by most minority assessment, not been particularly good for them. And now, I think the candidates who were there made really good cases for the way in which, from their ideological point of view, what they're doing and what they're proposing works for African Americans mostly, but also Hispanics. I mean, that was the target audience there. And I think that those who showed up made a good case. The trouble is, this is not their base, and they are, you know, tactically, do I want to go there if I'm a leader? Probably not.
Yeah. I guess the interesting thing I would find, first of all, is I agree that certainly showing if they have the physical stamina to sustain themselves through a campaign, but I often think, again, with our new way we campaign, even though our communication system is so much better, we should be able to be informed more quickly than we were historically. But I think of an FDR who certainly left a long ongoing stamp on history and the legacy in our country, and yet he was certainly someone very struggling with his physical condition, and I wonder how someone that great in terms of a leadership role in this country and its history would have sustained this type of thing. And the other thing, I guess we could go on at another time to debate the Republican, at least the modern perception of the Republican Party and its views on the minority needs of our of the black community, because I think historically, if someone really does their homework, they'll see who is really doing the significant things, including the Voting Rights Act, that is still up coming into the 60s and 70s, has had a positive impact that LBJ, for example, signed on only knew what when he realized the train was leaving the station and he better get on the engine and look like the leader.
I'll agree with you historically, Margaret, but the Republican Party has changed, I think, unfortunately. The other thing that I would say is Tavis Smiley ran a great debate, and those questions that came from all people of color were really good questions. That is one of the best-run debates I have seen.
What I'd like both of you just to comment on the Gina 6 situation in Gina, Louisiana. The latest in the news there, the 17-year-old Michael Bell was freed on bail yesterday. He's one of the group of black students known as the Gina 6 who are accused of beating a white classmate who was among the white classmates apparently who hung nooses from a tree in the schoolyard. What does this big protest there last week, demonstrations over the treatment of the black youth, what does this tell you, Georgia Gerslotti, about, I don't know, the state of race relations, the racial justice?
Well, you know, when we see the report coming out, and this is a little misleading because it's talking about actually staying in dorm beds, but, yeah. You know, the 1 in 3 proportion of African Americans in prison compared to in dorm beds. I mean, this is a travesty. There is a long history of the unequal application of justice to people of color and white people in this country. And even though it's all surrounding the history of Little Rock that we were celebrating, and I was left reflecting upon how far we've come, it still shows us how far we have to go.
Margaret Farrell?
Well, I guess I would agree that there are certain areas that can be pointed to, community to community or whatever, you know, we're talking about parts of the country to other parts of the country. We're still all fallible human beings, and everybody has their weaknesses, and those have to be overcome either personally or as communities. I think the only thing that I was troubled with all the attention that was brought to this is that originally we think of a Rosa Parks. We think of the innocent type of individual who was trying to require people to pay attention to constitutional rights. And that's all of those examples, including Little Rock, should be a part of our history as a reminder to what it should not be again and what we should be correcting. I guess going into the criminal side of an action, regardless of the background, I found the attention in terms of someone who is charged with something that he did or didn't do, and that will still apparently carry out in the courts, but as I understand it now at the juvenile court level, I guess I found all of that effort behind someone who has done something wrong was somewhat troubling, even though I know that you can say, well, they were reacting to, you know, the pressures they were feeling. I just think there was other ways to try to get at the issue without doing what I found to be incredible. I think it was a very peaceful demonstration, as far as I understand from everything I saw or read. But I just thought it was interesting that that was the way they chose to use their energy at that time.
The part that troubles me, Margaret, is attempted murder. That's what they were charged with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that is so over the top. And, you know, unbelievable that they charged them with attempted murder. To me, that is evidence of this way in which justice is not meted out fairly.
On another issue, the average reading ability for 4th and 8th grade black students in Wisconsin is the lowest of any state. The gap between black and white is worst. Wisconsin is the worst in the nation for this achievement gap. Overall, Wisconsin students are doing better than the national average, but this gap is the worst in the nation. What do you think of that, Margaret Farrell?
Well, I guess I would love to see the whole report. What I read in some of the news reports of it troubled me because the statistics used almost were adding 1 and 0 and getting 3 or something. I found the whole reporting of it very interesting. And I think those types of, or those almost lumps of data, mm-hmm. especially in the hands of people who aren't quite aware of what they were supposed to be giving evidence to, I think can be very misleading. I think, having said that, and having always been a little skeptical of statistics, I admit, I would say that we have a real problem. We have a problem in our urban settings. We have a problem with young women, single mothers trying to raise children who themselves in some way had either a very negative experience or for whatever reason did not complete their education. I see, for example, in my own family, my children raising their children and spending a lot of time reading with them at night as part of their school curriculum. They sit down and read with them for half an hour in the evening, either to them when they're very young or listening to them read. And I am so impressed with the energy that is going into their overall education. Now, to transcend that into what all the children in our state need means we've got to have a lot of adult support and verification and validation of education. And having been educated as a teacher and did a little of it before I started raising my own family, I have a great respect for what happens in the classroom, but I know it has to be supported and added to by the efforts of the home. And I think that is very hard for some of our parents to be able to fit that into their work schedule and to fit it into their own personal experience.
Well, it's certainly hard to fit it into a work schedule when you're working two or three low-wage jobs in order to make ends meet, and that's certainly part of the problem here. And I think we just ought to, you know, like, let's cut the K-12 budget some more and see if that doesn't help. I think this is an embarrassment to the state. I think it's a travesty to those individual children. I think that this should be a much higher concern than it seems to be. It's somehow as though if it's just the African-American kids, the rest of the state doesn't worry about it because they're a relatively small proportion of the population. I mean, I think this is something that we should be really concerned about.
David in Menasha. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I brought a different caller on, but go ahead, Margaret Farrell.
I just wanted to add those. Can I call you Georgia?
Sure,
I don't know
sure,
if
please.
I'm
yes.
a youth professor. With my experience in state budgets, as a state, we still rank we're in the upper number 10 of the states in the country, though we are in the very middle or right below middle in our ability as a earning state of individuals paying taxes. We have always been in the top 10, if not the top 5, of what we commit out of our state funding to education compared to other states. I don't think dollars are always the answer. I am sure they're not always the answer. I think we have to constantly be challenged and challenge our educators to find the best way and the best curricula to be able to educate our children and to draw the community into the schools as participants. We have the money right now in our schools. Anyone who says we don't fund our schools enough are saying they just want more, and they're used to a very high level of funding and want it to continue. We have made that commitment on all our levels of education. And, I know the budget debate is another thing we may talk about, but we've made the commitment.
Milwaukee Public Schools are not the same as Whitefish Bay schools or Waukesha schools. It is just as simple as that.
Well, I would also say, though, dollars aren't the answer because they are being funded to a far greater level than many of the schools around the country, and they have money. And 78% of what the Milwaukee Public Schools are spending is money coming to them from the state of Wisconsin taxpayers who are, in fact, through our education formula of funding schools, who are giving the money to the schools to do the best they can. And I think
and something's still not working.
Well, there's still problems, I agree, but I think the community and the parents have to be involved to a greater extent.
Well, I grant you that. It's harder to do when you're working a couple, three low-wage jobs.
And that's what comes of not having a good education yourself to be able to get a better job.
And we don't allow the mothers to go to college with the help from state anymore. They have to work these low-wage jobs.
No, unfortunately, they made some choices early on that if any of us made those choices, would have found ourselves somewhat limited in what we can do also.
Now, let me change the subject. We will go back to the state budget in just a moment, but Reed in Clintonville has another issue he'd like to bring up. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good morning, and thanks for this opportunity. being only the second person to be able to call in nearly 40 minutes of the program. I would hope that
We go from issue to issue to issue, Reed. So why don't you bring up your issue?
The issue I would like to address or have the guests address is the Annette Ziegler issue. Who now Annette will evidently have her day in court in front of or with two judges ruling on what I perceive to be a deception perpetuated. On the Wisconsin voters by her telling us that she had no conflict of interest, and evidently there is. And I suspect that her decisions on the Wisconsin Supreme Court from here on out will always be suspicious. She has, if not perpetrated a deception, perhaps it's a blatant lie, out-and-out lie, that she did not have any conflict of interest.
All right. Thank you very much, Reed. Georgia Durcelotti, you want to comment on this probe and the board asking for more information before handing out the punishment?
Well, I think that a Supreme Court judge should demonstrate good judgment, and I think she didn't. And I think that's a problem. And it will be interesting to watch and see how the court struggles to maintain its integrity and the trust in it, which is critical for courts to work properly, given this cloud that hangs over this, her now.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Farrell?
Well, I guess what I would say that is it's the first time this type of issue has arisen or been asked to be clarified in any of the either candidates or sitting judges or justices. And it will be interesting from the process standpoint to see how it is actually handled now that the ethics issue has, part of it has been settled, as we know. I think that the issue is, was there any gain? Is the conflict, we have a conflict if there is a gain. And the issue is, was there any gain to her, or did she see there could even be a way to see any type of nominal or any much less significant, which I don't think is entered in at all to the discussion, gain to herself or to her husband by her reviewing what were repossessions of autos and things of that type that were on paper on loans made by the bank that her husband was on the board of. I don't see where she probably saw that. I don't know if that shows bad judgment on those specific things. I don't know her thought process, but it certainly is a unique situation. And to have it be seen as the very first time this type of conflict ever happened, I guess I would challenge that in the history of the state and its court operations. To see it as the first time it has come to light and challenged in this context, we certainly know that that's the case.
Our guest today for the Week in Review, Margaret Farrell, former lieutenant governor, currently active in public policy-related organizations, chair of the Waukesha County Action Network, and chair of the board of Wisconsin Eye, and Georgia Durcelotti, also with us, a professor of political science at Beloit College and author, most recently, of Creating Gender, the Sexual Politics of Welfare Policy. 1-800-642-1234. If you have an issue from the news this week that you would like to bring up, we're going to be moving into more state budget issues as well. So especially if there's something to do with the state budget, that would be on topic. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. A new field has emerged to assist families in the financial, legal, and medical issues in caring for older Americans. After 9, Kathleen is joined by the president of the National Association of Professional Geriatric Care Managers. That's coming up in our next hour. We are reviewing the news of the week with Georgia Durcelotti and Margaret Farrell, and with you, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. We don't get to as many callers as we would in a typical hour, the Friday Week in Review. We have two guests, and we cover a whole bunch of different issues, so we move on from issue to issue and we probably won't go backwards. So that's why we don't have as many callers on as usual. Let's talk, before we talk about this, the state budget, I meant to bring up the two-day strike against General Motors by the United Auto Workers Union. A tentative agreement was reached on Wednesday, and everybody's back to work now. But some people are troubled by the union taking over this, administering the retiree health care benefits, which is sort of a shift in how things are done. Is this a good deal for workers or for the company, or what do you make of it, Margaret Farrell?
Well, I guess I'm anxious to see the details. I think, you know, with any of these, we kind of get the general statement about what was decided, and I'm not sure. I think my sense is that it was agreed to was an amount that will be more or less, in other parlance, an endowment, a figure that is going to be put into that must meet in some way the needs that are out there and the potential needs as people retire. We all know that part of healthcare is becoming the most difficult to control because more and more of us, fortunately, are living longer and longer and are pretty healthy doing that until toward the end when they say we spend the majority of our healthcare dollars in the last several years of one's life, generally, if you go again with statistics. So there is an ongoing problem with how you cap that. I think from the company standpoint, if I understand it right, it gives them a certain amount, a sum certain, that they are now providing for this. And the union, which has a lot of administrative experience, is going to be the one listening very closely to their members and their retired members in fulfilling that need. There are other elements of that settlement that I find extremely interesting if one understands them. The amount that has been brought out, and that is the one where they have General Motors agreeing to hire a number of temporary workers, which will increase the ranks of the UAW, because all of those members will become union members. If you had told the union 10 years ago they would be working toward having temporary workers become part of their workforce, I think they would have completely scorned that and said, well, that's ridiculous. That's how the economy and financial needs are certainly adjusting people's minds.
Well, certainly we have a change in unions and what they are able to do in the global economy. And unfortunately for most American workers, it means that they get less pay, fewer benefits. We are not taking care of our workers in ways that Henry Ford showed made a lot of economic sense. I think this really highlights the need to fix the healthcare system. And I think that the Americans who are accustomed to the employer-based healthcare system don't understand the ways in which it puts our whole economy at a competitive disadvantage. And no place is this more clear than in the auto industry. So that, you know, if we had a better national solution to healthcare, we would not be passing those costs on so much to particular industrial sectors, and that would help us. I think, as Margaret said, that this is a really creative approach given these enormous constraints, and I look forward to seeing how this plays out. It rather reminds me of, we talk about states as laboratories in the federal system, and the UAW and GM are big enough that it really is GM and UAW as a laboratory for other large organizations.
Margaret Farrell, do you think we're going to have a budget by tomorrow or by the end of the day today?
I don't.
How come?
If I can believe everything I'm listening to on Wisconsin Eye, because of the reports I've heard, I think that it's very, very sad. I really do, and I don't mean to make light of it by laughing. I've been on those conference committees, and I've been on Joint Finance, and I know how difficult it is for partisans to sit down at a table with different principles, kind of bringing them to that point, and different the different voices speaking to them from their constituents, then somehow finding a way to compromise. And it has to be done. It has to be done in Washington, where they're struggling with the same thing and haven't passed one of their 12 budget bills yet. And it has to be done at our state level. But I think the sad thing is that it started so late. Unfortunately, my former colleagues in the state Senate, when the Senate leadership brought the budget to the floor, they suddenly, out of out of thin air, emerged with this universal health care plan, which they themselves didn't have enough either confidence or respect in, that they didn't bring it through the legislative process. They didn't convince the governor to make it part of his budget initially. They didn't bring it up during joint finance, but instead they plunked it down on the desks of the morning of the debate of the budget with no warning, and then made it one of the big chips that they were going to bring to the conference table. Now they have finally said, well, we'll put that aside, even though it was a larger sum than the budget itself, a larger spending need cost rather than the entire compared to the whole budget. And now supposedly they're getting serious about what they will or won't do. I find that very troubling that we went through several months of having that kind of large gorilla in the room without it having any standing, in my opinion. And well, having said it, we've got $6.5 billion worth of new spending and new taxes in this budget as it exists over the next 2 years. That is just going to take an awful lot of money out of the state that could stay in the private sector for ultimately for spending and for job creation and to keep us competitive, so we're not even more onerous on the tax side.
Well, there is a question about the way health care is playing out right now for economic competitiveness, and that having the kind of system that we have right now may not be the most economic competitive way of structuring it. You know, I don't think that the Republicans in the Assembly want a budget, and it looks to me, and I've asked around on this, that it you know, two real reasons. One of them is an ideological reason that perhaps one could agree with. I think it's very short-sighted, but they don't want a budget because they don't really like government. They believe in unfettered markets with no budget, then they don't add anything more to government. They really don't believe that if at the state level they don't pass this budget, that the locals will pass on as much in taxes because it's so much harder to do at the local level. But I think more importantly, and this comes out in some of the press that they have been quite deliberately working on, to use it as a strategy to make it seem like the party in power, and this would be the Democrats because they hold two of the three pieces, are really ineffectual, and therefore it'll be a competitive advantage for them in the election cycle. And to me, that's deplorable. And, you know, we are undermining our human capital, our competitive advantage through our university systems, through our schools, through other kinds of job training. We are undermining the state's infrastructure in terms of roads and other kinds of infrastructure. We're going to lose lots of matching funds that we have. I mean, over $400 million in health and family services alone. In my Congress class that I'm teaching right now, we've been looking back at sessions of Congress and seeing what the configuration was and what was happening in the world at the time. And really, just yesterday it struck me, it reminded me of Reagan's first Congress when he had the Republican Senate for the first time, and they just went through and really gutted programs on this trickle-down economic theory, and it was, you know, just really no compromise with the Dems in the House. And it seems to me it's that same kind of strategy that's being used by the Assembly Republicans right now, and I think it's really detrimental.
Yeah. The latest wire story from the Associated Press ran at 3 o'clock this morning. A deal on Wisconsin's long-overdue state budget could be near, or it might not be. It all depends on who's talking, as legislative leaders give mixed signals on this week's private talks aimed at reaching a budget compromise. There is some concern that this isn't before Wisconsin I, Margaret Farrow, but behind closed doors. Any problem with that?
Well, I think there's a certain level of negotiations that either informally or formally takes place outside of the glare of lights, just because that's how things generally finally get nailed down. I think the substantive things that, first of all, the legislature in its wisdom, and I say that in quotes, because it happened in the 70s when I was in local government, but they exempted themselves, or their caucuses, I should say, from the open meetings law. I don't know if that's good or bad, but the important thing is the product that comes out of any process reflects the process. I strongly believe that, and that's why I mentioned earlier that the process was somewhat ignored when the health care bill was plunked in the way it was into the budget debate rather than following the usual process. But I think to characterize that the Republicans don't want a budget, I disagree with that completely. I think they want a responsible budget that can be afforded by the state. And the budget that was introduced by the governor, first of all, the governor and many of his cabinet members, which I find interesting the way they are becoming part of this whole political picture to this extent, they've been around the state with all the school superintendents saying we have to have the budget, the school numbers nailed down by mm-hmm. today. And all of a sudden now they're saying, well, wait a minute, why, you know, the Republicans said, okay, this is the way we can do it. We'll fund it. Here's your school budget. And now they are saying, oh, no, no, you're making it political when they're answering what was asked for, knowing how difficult the rest of the budget is going to be because there is so much new tax dollars in it and the way that it has been constructed. I mean, $6.5 billion of new taxes for the next 2 years. And that can be documented, plus about another close to $1 billion on new property taxes because the cap's been raised from 2% growth in local government spending to 4%. Those are real dollars coming out of taxpayers' pockets. I'm not saying government shouldn't be there. Republicans don't say that. We're saying be responsible, be effective, and be efficient. And the way you've always done it may not be the best way to do it. Let's find better ways to deliver those services rather than just asking for more money.
Anything else? Well, go ahead, Georgia.
I actually think that you were a responsible Republican when you were in when it came to the – I'm not sure that some of the folks who are in the Assembly now are.
Well, I thank you. Personally, I'll thank you philosophically.
Georgia Durslady, what do you think of this this separate education budget that the Assembly did pass?
Well, you know, I was on the school board for 6 years, and it is really critical to get this out. But unfortunately, I think it was a tactic because you pulled this central, you know, this is the centerpiece of the state budget, K-12 education. And this is what people all across the state pay attention to. You pull this out, and then you try to negotiate the rest of the budget. Suddenly, a whole area that can be in play and, you know, force the hand of intransigent Assembly caucus members who don't want to budge on anything, you know, this is a real tool for the Democrats to get them to compromise when there seems to not be compromise going on. So I think it was quite a political ploy to pull it out, even though it's also very needed.
Yeah. Well, boy, we have less than a minute to go. Georgia Durslady, was there something in the news this week in 30 seconds that you want to note that you think was worth talking about?
Something that came and went that is really below the radar screen is that Verizon denied NARO the right to use their service for text messaging to their members. Yeah. And this, to me, you know, we really need to look at how free speech works when a commercial entity can deny free speech, basically. Mm-hmm. And while we say it's private sector and they get to do what they want, I don't think that this is true, and we should look at that. They did, by the way, recant.
We will look into that. And Margaret Farrow, 30 seconds or so on an issue that we haven't talked about that
you think
is worth noting?
Well, I think just emerging toward the end of the week is something I find absolutely incredible in that Miller Brewery has given its backing to that event that is just incredible in San Francisco, and to fly in the face of the 60% of the country who are Protestant and 25% Catholic, and to do something is almost so insulting in terms of what they are doing with that the leather event in San Francisco this weekend is just amazing.
I wish we had time to talk about that. Margaret Farrell, thanks very much for being with us. We are out of time. And Georgia Durslady, thank you, too.
Always a pleasure. Yeah. Good to be with you.
Yeah, Margaret Farrell, former Lieutenant Governor, Georgia Durslady, Professor of Political Science at Beloit College. Thanks to Karen Prager and Christina Taylor for producing This Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.